called it a buffet of blockbusters. So we've been talking about this blockbuster. That was a new one for me.
Yeah. All right. Well, we're going to munch on it this morning.
I like it. Welcome to Respecting Religion, a BJC podcast series where we talk about what's at stake for faith freedom for all in 2020. I'm Amanda Tyler, Executive Director of BJC.
And I'm General Counsel Holly Holman. Today we're going to discuss two decisions that were released at the end of the Supreme Court's term. And we're going to reflect on this season of Respecting Religion as we record our 20th episode in the series. Hi, Amanda.
Hi, Holly.
It's good to see you as I stay here in Northern Virginia, where we continue to follow the daily news reports of COVID infections, some going up, unfortunately, in our area, but also just really watching that, trying to make good decisions and see how this is going to affect us in the fall. And I'm really excited to see that you are somewhere else. You had a little chance to relocate for a few weeks.
Yes, I am recording from a new location farther north, still on the eastern seaboard. I'm in Maine for a few weeks, and it is wonderful to get out into nature. I've traded the Washington, D.C. heat for a much cooler climate, and most importantly for our family, my five-year-old son now has a playmate. It's been a long time in this pandemic with him just having his two parents to play with, so
I bet.
We are all enjoying this change of pace.
Well, I'm very happy for you all to get away and to get that little break from the intensity of the city. And I know that will serve you well as you return in a few weeks.
Well, we left town on the last day of the Supreme Court's term. So good timing on our part. The latest maybe that the Supreme Court has gone, at least in my time of watching the court, to go this far into the summer. It's the end of this blockbuster term that we've been talking about all season on Respecting Religion.
That's right. Everyone is used to those radio reports where they report on a case and say a decision is expected by the end of June. But this year, we didn't hear those. Those were conspicuously missing from reports of Supreme Court cases in the media. And the decisions came out all the way until July 9th.
Yeah. And on July 8th, we got a couple of cases that were important to us and our work. And I was reading one of the many roundups of the term in the New York Times, and their Supreme Court reporter, Adam Liptak, called it a buffet of blockbusters. So we've been talking about this blockbuster term. That was a new one for me.
Yeah. All right. Well, we're going to munch on it this morning.
I like it. He also talked about in his article, his theme was that Chief Justice Roberts, how often he was found in the majority of cases,
right,
and kind of his moderating presence for these cases. And this term, we also had fewer 5-4 decisions. One of them was the Espinosa case we talked about last week, but we had many more 7-2 decisions this term, including two 7-2 decisions that we're going to talk about today.
Yeah, I think some commentators like to reflect on those numbers to show perhaps that the court is more stable, less divided than the other branches. I don't know if I agree with that or not, but it's good to have at the end of the term kind of look at where we are. As we also note that today we learned that Justice Ginsburg was back in the hospital, and we certainly wish her speedy recovery. And she's amazing. We'll be talking about one of the cases where she participated very well in oral argument from the hospital. So
that's right.
While we all are thinking about her and hoping that she's doing well, it's always just a reminder of the sensitivity, the fact that many members of the court are older, and that at any given time we could have a retirement or death or anything that changes the makeup of the court and really affects things. So with that, we should launch in and talk about, first of all, the ministerial exception cases. These were two cases that were consolidated, and we talked about these cases on the podcast way back in episode 13. The cases, I think, will be known by the Our Lady of Guadalupe school moniker. But these were two cases, and the issue was whether teachers at Catholic elementary schools could sue their employer for employment discrimination, or whether they were precluded because of a doctrine called the ministerial exception. So really the issue is whether the ministerial exception would cover employees like these two teachers in these two cases. One had sued for age discrimination and one had sued for disability discrimination.
And in short, the Supreme Court said, yes, that the ministerial exception would cover these two teachers and that the lower courts had erred in letting their cases go forward in spite of this exception.
That's right. The ministerial exception under the religion clauses of the First Amendment forecloses the adjudication of employment discrimination claims of Catholic school teachers in these cases. And we keep saying in these cases, of course, to remind our listeners, you know, the court decides the case in front of it based on the facts that they have, but they set out principles that are intended to apply to other cases. So we understand the scope of this case to be that the ministerial exception applies to similarly situated teachers as these. These are teachers in a religious school environment who have some responsibility for teaching religion. As you said, it was a 7-2 decision, or it fell in that category of the 7-2 decisions. And it was not really surprising to me, Amanda, that Justice Alito wrote the majority opinion.
Yeah, he was pretty active at oral argument. Again, in episode 13 of this series, we went over oral argument, played some clips from oral argument, and he seemed to have a lot of interest in this case. The Supreme Court precedent that was looming in this case was this case of Hosanna Tabor from several years ago. And in that case, he had written a significant concurrence. We thought that it was likely that he would be involved in writing the majority opinion.
Yeah, and Hosanna Tabor was a unanimous decision, a 9-0 case. It was the first time the Supreme Court had specifically recognized and upheld this doctrine of the ministerial exception. And in doing so, they said that the doctrine was grounded in both religion clauses, the free exercise clause and no establishment clause. And the doctrine recognizes that courts really are incompetent to decide matters of essential religious teaching. We sometimes call it ecclesiastical questions. So things that really are at the core of religion, like how a religion governs itself, how it's organized, and how it determines matters of faith and doctrine. And because of those, that limitation on courts that we recognize in the First Amendment, the ministerial exception says that there is this certain class of employees in which the court will really just stay, you know, they will stay out of any conflict about. So they will give religious institutions basically carte blanche to make their decisions about who is a minister. And in Hosanna Tabor, as I said, it was a 9-0 case. And that's probably because people would say that's an easy case, even though it did deal with a teacher, as we have teachers in this case. And that might be different for people when they're thinking about a minister. Not everyone can see the word minister applied to teachers, maybe depending on your own experience or denominational background. But in that case, the teacher had a deep education, was known as a called teacher, had a special something like ordination. So based upon her education, her title, and the way she was held out in her religious community, she fit that ministerial exception. And so in this case, the question was whether or not, absent some of those other factors, these teachers would also fall under the ministerial exception.
Yeah. And, you know, I think you mentioned the importance of church autonomy or the importance that religious institutions can govern their own internal affairs. And that was certainly an aspect of the case that was quite a bit discussed at oral argument. And we noted when we talked about the case previously, just how uncomfortable the justices at oral argument seemed to be and even wading into some of these more internal affairs. And in his majority opinion, Justice Alito really highlighted this particular aspect and linked the teaching of what he called faith and doctrine to a matter of church affairs. Justice Alito clarified, this does not mean that religious institutions enjoy a general immunity from secular laws, but it does protect their autonomy with respect to internal management decisions that are essential to the institution's central mission. And a component of this autonomy is the selection of the individuals who play certain key roles.
Yeah, I think when Justice Alito wrote that, he is defending a bit more, kind of reiterating the defense of the basis of the ministerial exception, because it is clear, it shows that it applies to quite a broad range of employees. You know, we always explain the ministerial exception as a doctrine that applies to a very narrow set of employees. And that's true, you know, ministers. But what the court had left open in Hosanna Tabor is kind of who decides that. And the court here made it clear that the court could decide that, but it also laid out a record that showed that teachers in elementary religious schools, in this particular case, you had two Catholic schools, in that setting and with the religious duties that they had, even though they didn't have a lot of specialized training, these teachers had some religious duties to pray with the students, to teach them about religion according to the school curriculum that was infused with faith and religious principles. And those kinds of religious duties fit this exception of being ministerial because, as you noted, Amanda, it relates to the faith and doctrine of the religious institution.
The court really took exception with the way that the lower courts in this case took their holding in Hosanna Tabor and turned it into more of a rigid test. And I saw, you know, in Justice Alito's opinion, he really tried to, I think, take this entire category of elementary school teachers and look at what they did as a whole instead of really trying to parse each particular duty or what each particular position might be called. And this is the quote from the opinion itself. He said, "What matters at bottom is what an employee does. And implicit in our decision in Hosanna Tabor was a recognition that educating young people in their faith, inculcating its teachings, and training them to live with faith are responsibilities that lie at the very core of the mission of a private religious school." So he's saying something, I think, very straightforward, simple, clear in that statement. Some of the dissenters, I think, took exception with how implicit that idea was in Hosanna Tabor. You know, dissenters who were in the majority in Hosanna Tabor, Justice Sotomayor and Justice Ginsburg, but were now in the minority in the dissent in this case.
Right. I think we have a decision that is true to Hosanna Tabor, but a little more hard to swallow for many people because of how we have seen this exception as something narrow. And it's important to describe it as something narrow is because its effect is so big. It means that you could never sue for these protected categories, even if you work for an employer who says it doesn't discriminate based upon gender, race, age, disability. You could never make that claim if you are in this category of ministerial. You have this now majority opinion saying that category extends to religion teachers. And the quote that you read, I think, is very helpful and it is clear. And there will be continued debate about whether or not institutions will act right or will sort of milk this and try to extend it to positions that really don't have significant religious functions. But I think the court did a good job showing the religious functions and duties that these teachers had in a way to justify that. And the dissent, I think, was saying that absent the factors in Hosanna Tabor, the factors of a special title, increased education, a sort of setting apart of particular employees, that this narrow exception now was quite large and could apply to so many more employees. And I think reasonable people can disagree about where exactly to draw these lines. So I appreciate the dissent's concerns, and it will remain to be seen whether or not religious institutions apply this doctrine broadly in a way that really deprives a significant population of anti-discrimination expectations.
Yeah. And, you know, as upset as the dissent was about how broad this exception was that the majority gave, it could have been much broader. Justice Thomas wrote a concurrence that Justice Gorsuch joined that would have given complete deference to a religious employer to designate any employee as a minister. And I think that certainly seems too broad. In that case, the exception completely swallows the rule here. And also, as we talked more in depth when we talked about this case before, you know, religious employers already have an exception when it comes to religious status in their hiring practices. Justice Alito's majority opinion still shows that there is some difference between employees working with religious employers, that in most cases, it would be difficult to see that every employee working for a religious employer would qualify for this ministerial exception. And I think, Holly, you know, the expectations of employees. I think that was something about this case that really offended some people's sensibilities, that these particular teachers evidently did not realize that they were not covered. The facts of the case showed that in one case, even their employee handbook stated that the employer would not discriminate on the basis of age. And maybe they were given the employee handbook for lay employees, not the employee handbook for ministerial employees. And I appreciated in your statement for BJC and our reaction, our official reaction to this case, you said, as a matter of fairness, this interpretation of a broader ministerial exception should also lead religious employers to clarify expectations with employees, not only about religious job duties, but about the limits of employment law protections. And I wholeheartedly agree. I think if we're going to have this broad exception, that it is important that employees realize this at the time of hiring and throughout their employment.
That's right. We'll see how religious institutions respond to this. And then, as you noted, this case is in a way related to the earlier case that we talked about last on the last podcast, the Espinoza case, where the court in that case sort of avoided the conclusion that there's something really distinct about religious schools and they wanted to treat them the same as other schools. And you tweeted that the problem is when it comes to religious schools, the court wants to have it both ways. Religious schools are just like all other private schools when it comes to funding. That's what they seem to be saying in Espinoza. But in these cases, the employment ministerial exception cases, the court does not treat these schools the same as other schools. And in fact, they have these broad exceptions that come into play.
Of course, friends of BJC know that we have maintained a firm line when it comes to government funding of religion. And one, although not the only reason we keep a firm position on government funding, is the reality that it becomes difficult, if not with the court over the past 2 weeks, then at least with the public, to justify treating religious institutions differently only when it comes to exemptions and not when it comes to funding.
That's right.
And of course, these ministerial exception cases don't arise in a vacuum. We've talked about how they've interacted with Espinoza. They also interact with the Title VII cases, the Bostick case that was decided a few weeks ago. And in Bostick, the court made clear that Title VII's protections against employment discrimination extend to LGBTQ individuals. So now that we have a broader ministerial exception than many people expected, many of these employees will not qualify for that protection. And in his wrap-up story about the court's term when it comes to religion, NPR's Tom Gelton, who is the correspondent for Religion and Belief, talked about the interaction of these cases and very wisely, I think, called you, Holly, to offer commentary on it. In his story, you were quoted as saying, I think there's high interest on the court, the more conservative majority, in sort of clarifying, cleaning up what's been known as a very complex area of the law. So these stories are pretty short. That's a sound bite. But here on Respecting Religion, we have more time and space to talk about these issues. You want to talk more about what you meant with that quote?
Sure. I mean, if anyone wants to go back to that story, there's now a transcript. We'll put a link in the show notes. I really appreciate NPR for doing a little bit more long form stories to do what Tom was trying to do, which was really reflect on the term and these cases where there was a larger than usual number of religion cases. And he was noting this interaction, and it's hard to do in one story, right? To make these conclusions about what the court did. I think we've got plenty to think about for the rest of the summer to try to figure out kind of what was meant and where we go from here. But when I said that, I was noting that at least in a couple of these cases, we do have new, clear, you know, decisions, holdings. We have clear holdings. Sex, as written in Title VII, includes sexual orientation and gender identity. The no aid provisions in state constitutions that were at issue in Espinoza and then a few terms ago, Trinity Lutheran, now will be seen as not standing on their own to treat religion differently. So those were sort of clarifying issues that people can still debate whether they were right or wrong, but they change how we go forward in these cases. And I say we broadly, depending on your advocacy perspective. From BJC's perspective, we worry that there is a loss sometimes with efforts for bright line rules that might tend to emphasize some values at the cost of others. We believe that no establishment and free exercise go hand in hand to create this religious liberty environment in our country that has served us very well. And it might be messy at times, but that also might be the genius that serves religious liberty.
Thanks, Holly. Let's take a break.
We're back. In this segment, we're going to talk about the court's decision in Trump v. Pennsylvania. And we talked about this case, really two cases, again, that were consolidated on the podcast way back in episode 12. A reminder, these are the contraceptive mandate cases. The Affordable Care Act provided preventative health care at no cost to employees that employers had to cover. And the Affordable Care Act delegated what kind of preventative services would be covered for women to an administrative agency that outlined the contraceptive mandate and a series of exemptions. The contraceptive mandate provides that FDA-approved contraceptives must be provided at no cost to the employee. The regulations also provided for certain exemptions in a two-tiered way that recognized religious liberty concerns for some religious employers.
Thanks, Holly, for that good wrap up at what is at issue here. This case is the third time that the Supreme Court has weighed in on this issue. The prior cases were the Hobby Lobby case and then the Zubik case. And we talk more about that background in episode 12.
So this case is Trump v. Pennsylvania, although consolidated with Little Sisters of the Poor Saints Peter and Paul Home versus Pennsylvania, because those Little Sisters intervened in this case because they had been involved in earlier challenges to the exemption regime and how it applied to religious entities that oppose contraceptive services for their employees. So in these cases, what's at issue is now the Trump administration's efforts to revise the administration regulations and change the exemptions to really broaden them so that Not only religious employers can take advantage of them to avoid paying for contraceptives in ways that their employees could get them, but instead created broad exemptions to basically not comply with the contraceptive mandate, leaving employees not covered in their contraceptive needs.
And in the case, the plaintiffs had challenged the ability of the administration to offer these broad exemptions, saying that that wasn't permitted under both the Affordable Care Act and the Administrative Procedures Act. And the majority, by a vote of 7-2, held that the agencies at issue here, the Departments of Health and Human Services, Labor, and the Treasury Department, had the authority under the Affordable Care Act to promulgate rules exempting employers with religious or moral objections from providing contraceptive coverage to their employees. And Justice Thomas had the majority opinion, writing for 7 justices in the holding. Justice Alito filed a concurring opinion in which Justice Gorsuch joined. Justice Kagan also filed an opinion concurring in the judgment that Justice Breyer joined, and Justice Ginsburg filed a dissenting opinion in which Justice Sotomayor joined. And we'll get into the specifics of all of those opinions in just a minute. I think before we get into what the opinions held, it's important to note on Respecting Religion podcast that the religious liberty issues in these cases are somewhat adjacent to the core of this particular iteration of the contraceptive mandate saga. I think we can call it at this point because we have 3 cases. And this case really turned on the specifics of the Affordable Care Act and the broad discretion that Congress gave to the agencies to define and enforce what's called the Women's Health Amendment. That part of the ACA instructs health plans to provide coverage for, quote, additional preventative care and screenings for women. And they left discretion to the agencies to define what that additional preventative care and screenings would be, and to left it to the agencies, of course, to enforce that as well. And I think we can see in this opinion that that discretion left to the agencies is what really led to the holding here that this was permitted, this broad exemption scheme that, as you noted, Holly, applies to all kinds of employers, not just religious employers, but also for-profit, even publicly traded companies. It also applies to all religious and moral objections, that this kind of broad exemption was within the authority of the ACA for the administration to promulgate, that that's really kind of the core of this opinion.
The prior law, which, Amanda, you're right, you acknowledge is administrative regulatory law that comes out of the statutory framework, provided these exemptions in recognition of religious liberty concerns. And the Obama administration crafted those exemptions. The intent appeared very plainly to be to make sure that these preventative healthcare services were widely available, but understanding a common religious liberty concern that some religions have about not being involved in certain kinds of contraceptives, it provided a narrow exemption for churches and their closely related entities, but then provided this accommodation scheme that really allowed religious objectors to not be involved in paying for or arranging for contraceptive coverage, but didn't deprive their employees from getting those services. And that's what BJC really defended in our brief that we worked with Professor Laycock in, that was discussed at the Zubik oral argument. So that was the second phase after Hobby Lobby, and whether the contraceptive mandate accommodation could apply to for-profit companies was decided. Then you had the Zubik cases where you had these religious affiliates saying the accommodation's not good enough, we're still too involved with this. And we defended that scheme of exemptions in the Zubik case. But there was some thinking that the court could send these cases back down and the administration could work it out. So these objections from Little Sisters and others were continuing, and the Obama administration's efforts to make sure the statute still provided what it was supposed to continued in the lower courts, but they weren't resolved at the time the Trump administration came in. So the Trump administration decided to change it and really approach it in a vastly different way that created these large exemptions that are not familiar to BJC in that they don't really look at the need for an accommodation on one side and the important government interest, in this case, preventative health care for women on an equal basis as men without any cost to the employees, on the other hand.
Right. There's really no balancing of the different interests involved. The Trump administration instead took the tack of, we'll just give total deference to any religious or moral objection, and that will solve the problem. And, you know, the state of Pennsylvania, the other plaintiffs in these cases, they challenged the regulations on a number of grounds. One question before the court was whether the agencies could look to RFRA or the Religious Freedom Restoration Act in promulgating their rules. And, you know, while RFRA was not explicitly part of the Obama administration's regulations, it was the vehicle that was used to challenge the regulations by Hobby Lobby and then the religious organizations that opposed the accommodation. The court here dismissed that argument. It said it's hard to see how the departments, and here speaking of the agencies in the Trump administration who promulgated these rules, how they could have done so consistent with their prior decisions in Hobby Lobby and Zubik if they did not overtly consider these entities' rights under RFRA. The court said if the agencies did not look to RFRA's requirements or discuss RFRA at all when formulating their solution, they certainly would be susceptible to claims that the rules were arbitrary and capricious, and that's an important term when it comes to agency review, and that they would be susceptible to claims that the rules for failing to consider an important aspect of the problem. So they dismissed that argument, but that's a far cry from what Justice Alito would have done in his concurrence in his argument that RFRA required an exemption that was this broad. He said, in my judgment, RFRA compels an exemption for the Little Sisters and any other employer with a similar objection to what has been called the accommodation to the contraceptive mandate.
It's unfortunate that Justice Alito is talking about the Religious Freedom Restoration Act in those terms because it really destroys what we see is the balance that is in RFRA. As we led the effort to really pass that law, we see accommodations and religious exceptions serving religious liberty because often they can be provided without harm to other important government interests. And so it's confusing that Justice Alito would say that RFRA compels an exemption that the religious affiliates choose that does not take care of the employees and their needs under the contraceptive mandate. I thought it was interesting that Justice Kagan filed a concurrence with Justice Breyer only agreeing in the judgment. So she writes separately, totally independent in her basis for why these regulations could be upheld. They will go back down to the lower court and will be reviewed again. And she brings up this administrative law kind of debate that's going on in the court and Congress, particularly during the Trump administration, about, you know, how to do this, how to pass regulations and enforce regulations, you know, whether or not they comply with the administrative process, or whether they fail because they appear arbitrary and capricious.
Yeah, and she really notes just how broad these are and seems particularly offended by the idea that publicly traded corporations can claim this exemption and also that employers can claim the exemption who just have a moral objection. That goes far beyond what RFRA would not only require, but even consider in determining an accommodation in this way.
So it goes back to the lower courts and we'll see if there's any clarification there or if this will all be upended if there's a change in administration. We know that this debate, this fight will continue over these important concerns. And that became very clear in the Ginsburg-Sotomayor dissenting opinion, where you could just see how Justice Ginsburg, writing in that dissent, wanted to emphasize the important underlying purpose of the contraceptive mandate. She really goes in great detail to, it feels like, sort of educate the other members of the court, as well as the public, about these services being part of preventative health care for women and how important that is. And we appreciate, of course, how she articulates the more common understanding of religious freedom, having this balance, something that can exempt certain religious actors from otherwise general neutral laws, at the same time meeting the important government interest so that third parties are not harmed or their interests aren't disregarded because of religious interest on the other side.
Yeah, and this idea that she says and that we agree with, that neither the Free Exercise Clause nor the Religious Freedom Restoration Act calls for such an imbalanced result, in her words. And in other words, that we don't have to cater to religious objectors to the nth degree. You know, in our briefing in Zubik, we talked about it, RFRA does not require complete deference to religious objectors. And so I was pleased that she articulated that so well in the dissent, that you can serve, in fact, you serve religious freedom interests in the best way when you look at them in a balanced way that balances the interests on both sides, both the government's interest in providing a benefit, but also the interests of the religious objectors.
So as we said in our earlier episode, third time is not a charm, and we're really just joking about how uncharming this whole debate is, and it is not over. So we will stay tuned and continue to do our part in helping understand and in any way we can shape this endeavor of accommodating religion while allowing government to work and serve interests for all people without regard to religion.
We will take a break and come back to wrap up this season of Respecting Religion. So Holly, here we are, segment three. We're going to do something a little different today. We are going to wrap up this entire first season of Respecting Religion.
I can't believe it's been 20 weeks, 20 episodes since this started. Yeah.
So when we started way back in February, we wanted to have a series where we could talk more in depth about the really important developments for religion and religious liberty. And we were looking at the news at that time and thinking that these conversations were really being crowded out, that they needed more airtime. And the news back in February, if we can remember then, seems like another decade, not just a few months. But, you know, we had a big impeachment trial in January. We had a very crowded Democratic primary, you know, debates that were held on two different nights. There were so many candidates. So those were the main stories. Little did we know, Holly, just what an important year 2020 would be.
Right. We were concerned about the news cycle not leaving room for us to talk about a Supreme Court term that had more religious liberty cases than is normal. We were concerned about executive action that was changing religious freedom expectations. And we had no idea about the coming spread of the coronavirus and this national conversation we're having about race and how religious liberty issues arose in those specific contexts. So I'm really thankful that we had this format, that we were ready to have these conversations, that we could sort of pivot and address these unbelievably novel issues. I mean, I would never have been able to guess that we would be talking about state police powers and the ability to keep people at home and have limits on religious gatherings. But as we discussed, those, you know, had some really important implications for religious liberty. I would have never guessed, you know, that we would be facing a kind of economic situation that would lead to recovery packages that affected houses of worship. So I'm really thankful for this podcast, and I trust that our listeners have been glad to be with us as we all had so much to navigate in the last several months.
Yeah, and I think pivot is the right word. We pivoted in so many ways. We pivoted to remote work. We pivoted to remote podcasting. We saw even the Supreme Court, sometimes the most unchangeable institution in American life, they pivoted to holding their oral arguments in a remote way, which allowed us to listen and react in a new way. And as they released all these opinions over the last week remotely again, we had the series available so that we could have conversations, real-time conversations to respond to these important issues. We've also all learned to live our lives on Zoom. It's has its ups and its downs, but it has inspired us to bring even more people into our conversations. That's not something we necessarily thought we would do when we were recording in person back in February, but we've brought in others to our conversation, like our colleague, BJC's Director of Education, Charles Watson Jr., when we talked about religious liberty and racism back in episode 16. We were able to bring in a recorded conversation of Eboo Patel from our last in-person event back in March, talking about interfaith collaboration in episode 9. And in episode 18, we were able to provide coverage of BJC's first ever virtual event on white supremacy and American Christianity when we brought in conversations between Robert P. Jones and Adele Banks and between Charles Watson and Dr. Alfonso Seville.
We have learned a lot. That's a great reminder and makes me very thankful for all that we've learned. And one thing that we've learned is that we still have a lot to learn when it comes to religious freedom and when it comes to addressing some of the systemic problems that face our country. And you and I and most of our BJC friends and family, and we know anyone who's listening here, are people who are dedicated to lifelong learning, and we will continue. But as my teenage boys will tell you, you got to have a summer break. So we are going to take a podcast break. We're wrapping up our 20th episode. So we now have a nice series on respecting religion that stands alone. And we hope our friends and listeners might recommend it to people who haven't heard it or use it as a resource. All the episodes are listed on the BJC website. So if there's a particular case or issue that you would like to hear us talk about, you can go back to listen to that or to recommend it to someone else. I will take this break, but of course, BJC podcast will be back. We hope that you all will subscribe and pass that on to other friends. If you feel so inclined, we appreciate your ratings. A 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts makes it easier for other people to find our podcast series. And leave a comment. Let us know what you've enjoyed and what you'd like to see more from BJC Podcast.
Thanks, Holly, for a great first season of Respecting Religion. I have learned a lot, and I've also had a lot of fun having these weekly conversations with you.
Me too. Thanks, Amanda.
That brings us to the close of this episode and this first season of Respecting Religion. Thanks for inviting us into your home or earbuds during this time of social distancing. Check out our show notes for links to the articles we mentioned today.
While we're on break, we hope you'll have time to catch up on the entire season. If you'd like, you can see a list of all episodes for this series on the BJC website. Visit bjconline.org/respectingreligion. And be sure to subscribe to the BJC podcast. We're on all the major platforms.
Let us know what you think of the show on social media. We're on Twitter and Instagram at @BJCOnTheHill. And you can follow me on Twitter at @AmandaTylerBJC. And get to know us. Visit our website at bjconline.org to see how we've been working for faith, freedom for all since 1936. As we wrap up this first season of Respecting Religion, we want to thank the many people who have made it possible. Thanks to my co-host and co-executive producer, Holly Holman, for bringing her expertise, insightful commentary, and humor to each of these conversations. It's been a joy to work with you, Holly.
And thank you, Amanda. It's been a lot of fun, and I appreciate your partnership as we tried this new experiment and worked together through the last 20 weeks to produce it. And thanks so much for your leadership for BJC and all the other endeavors that we've continued to go through this time of working from home. And I must say now, thanks to Sherilyn Crow, our producer and editor extraordinaire, who's worked her magic each week to bring you these episodes. Not only does she have supreme technical skills, but her constructive guidance has been invaluable.
I concur. I want to also thank our colleagues and weekly podcast review team, Chris Kearns McCoy, Christine Browder, and Jennifer Hawks. And thanks to Juliana who designed the artwork for this series.
And thanks to you, our loyal listeners, for listening and sharing the podcast and taking the time to give us your encouragement and feedback. We look forward to being back with you.